Chapter 37.
Something is wrong. Something is still missing.
What?
Bob is all geared up to protect our new creation.
If step three is right, if we have to subordinate everything to the decision that we made on the constraint,
oh,
then...
Oh, come on, Ralph. What's all this, if we have to subordinate? Is there any doubt that we must subordinate the non-constraints to the constraints? What are the schedules that you generate on your computers, if not the act of subordinating everything to our decision about the bottleneck's work?
I don't doubt that. But when the nature of the constraint has changed, one would expect to see a major change in the way we operate all non-constraints.
That makes sense. So what is bothering you?
Well, I don't recall that we did such changes.
Hey, he's right. I don't recall it either.
We didn't.
Maybe we should have.
Let's examine it. When was the first time the constraint changed?
It happened when some green tag parts started arriving at assembly too late. Remember our fear that new bottlenecks were popping up?
Yes, and then Jonah came and showed us it wasn't new bottlenecks, but that the constraint had shifted to being the way we released work to the plant.
Yeah, I still remember the shock of restricting the release of material, even though the people had practically nothing else to work on.
And our fear that efficiencies would drop. In retrospect, I'm amazed that we had the courage to do it.
We did it because it made perfect sense. Reality certainly proved us right. So, Ralph, in that case at least, we did affect all the non-constraints. Should we move on? Ralph doesn't answer. Something still troubling you?
Yes, but I can't put my finger on it.
What's the problem, Ralph? You, Bob, and I generated the work list for the constraints. Then you made the computer generate release dates for all material based on that list. We definitely changed the way we operated a non-constraint. That is, if we consider the computer as a non-constraint. Then, I made my people obey those computer lists. That was a major change in the way they operate, especially when you consider how much pressure the foreman put on them to supply them with work.
But you must admit the biggest change was on the shop floor. It was very difficult for most people to swallow that we really meant they shouldn't work all the time. Don't forget that the fear of layoffs was hanging heavily above us.
I guess it's all right.
What did we do with the method we were using? You know, the green and red tags?
Nothing. Why should we do anything about it?
Thank you, Lou. That's exactly what was bothering me. Stacy, do you remember the reason for using those tags in the first place? We wanted to establish clear priorities. We wanted each worker to know what is important and must be worked on immediately and what is less important.
That's right. That's exactly why we did it. Oh, I see what you mean. Now, not like in the past when we released stuff just to provide work, now whatever we release to the floor is basically of the same importance. Let me think for a minute. Oh, shit.
What's the matter?
I just realized the impact that those darn tags have on our operation.
Well?
Ugh, I'm embarrassed. I've been complaining about our problems with the 6 or 7 capacity constraint resources. I raised all the red flags. I've gone as far as to demand that incoming orders be restricted. And now I see that I've created the problem with my own hands.
Fill us in, Stacy. You're way ahead of us.
Of course. You see, when do the green and red tags have an impact? Only when a work center has a queue, when the worker has to choose between 2 different jobs that are waiting. Then he always works on the red tag first.
So?
The largest queues are in front of the bottlenecks, but there the tags are irrelevant. The other place where we have relatively high queues is in front of the capacity constraint resources. These resources supply some parts to the bottlenecks, red tag parts, but they work on many more green tag parts, parts that go to assembly, not through the bottlenecks. Today, they do the red tag parts first. This naturally delays the arrival of the green parts to assembly. We catch it when it's pretty late, when holes are already evident in the assembly buffer. Then, and only then, we go and change the priorities at those work centers. Basically, we restore the importance of the green parts.
So what you're telling us is that if you just eliminate the tags, it'll be much better?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. If we eliminate the tags and we instruct the workers to work according to the sequence in which the parts arrive, First come, first done, the parts will be done in the right sequence. Fewer holes will be created in the buffers. My people will not have to track where the material is stuck.
And the foreman will not have to constantly reshuffle priorities.
Stacy, are you positive that your warning about those constraint resources was just a false alarm? Can we safely take more orders?
I think so. It explains one of my biggest mysteries, why there are so few holes in the bottleneck's buffers, while there are more and more in the assembly buffer. By the way, fellows, the fact that there are more and more holes indicates that eventually we will run into the problem of insufficient capacity, but not right now. I'll take care of those tags immediately. You won't see them tomorrow.
Well, this discussion was very beneficial. Let's carry on. When was the second constraint broken?
When we started shipping everything much ahead of time. Shipping 3 weeks earlier is a clear indication that the constraint is no longer in production, but it's in the market. Lack of sufficient orders limited the plant from making more money.
Correct. What do you think? Did we do anything different on the non-constraints?
Not me.
Me neither. Hey, wait a minute. How come we continue to release material according to the oven and the NCX-10 if they're no longer the constraints?
We look at each other. Really? How come?
Something even funnier is going on. How come my computer shows that these two work centers are still a constraint, that they're constantly loaded to 100%?
Stacy, do you know what's going on?
I'm afraid I do. It's definitely not my day.
In all this time, I wondered why our finished goods were not depleting at a faster rate.
Hey, well, why don't you tell us what's going on?
Go ahead, Stacy.
Come on, fellas. Don't look at me like that. After operating for so long with mountains of finished goods, wouldn't anybody do the same?
Do what? Will you please stop talking in riddles?
We all knew how important it was to make the bottlenecks work all the time. Remember, an hour lost on the bottleneck is an hour lost for the entire plant. So when I realized that the load on the bottlenecks was dropping, I issued orders for products to be on the shelf in stock. Stupid, I know now, but at least at the moment our finished goods are balanced to roughly 6 weeks. No more of that awful situation where we hold mountains of some products and not even one single unit of others.
That's good. It means we can easily deplete it. Alex, be careful not to do it too fast. Remember the bottom line ramifications.
Why shouldn't we get rid of the finished products as fast as possible?
Never mind. Lou can and should explain it to all of you later. Right now, we should correct our 5-step process. Now, we all know to what extent Ralph was right. Something is definitely missing.
Can I correct it?
Stacy goes to the board. When she returns to her seat, the board has the following. 1. Identify the system's constraints. 2. Decide how to exploit the system's constraints. 3. Subordinate everything else to the above decision. 4. Elevate the system's constraints. 5. Warning. If in the previous steps a constraint has been broken, go back to step 1, but do not allow inertia to cause a system's constraint.
Ugh. It's much worse than I thought.
On the contrary, it's much better than I thought. You first. Why do you claim that it's much worse?
Because I've lost my only guideline. All the changes that we made so far, all the sacred cows that we had to slaughter, had one thing in common. They all stem from cost accounting. Local efficiencies, optimum batch sizes, product cost, inventory evaluations, all came from the same source. I didn't have much problem with it. As a controller, I questioned cost accounting validity for a long time. Remember, it's an invention from the beginning of the century when conditions were much different from today. As a matter of fact, I started to have a very good guideline. If it comes from cost accounting, it must be wrong.
Very good guideline. But what's your problem?
Don't you see? The problem is much bigger. It's not only cost accounting. We put on the green and red tags not because of cost accounting, but because we realize the importance of the bottlenecks. Stacy created orders for finished goods because of our new understanding, because she wanted to make sure that the bottleneck's capacity will not be wasted. I thought that it takes a lot of time to develop inertia. What I see now is that it takes less than 1 month.
Yes, you are right. Whenever the constraint is broken, it changes conditions to the extent that it's very dangerous to extrapolate from the past.
As a matter of fact, even the things that we put in place in order to elevate the constraint must be re-examined.
Well, how can we do it? It's impossible to question everything every time.
Something is still missing.
Something is definitely still missing.
Alex, it's your turn to explain.
Explain what?
Why did you claim that it's much better?
It's about time for some good news. Fellows, what stopped us from once again taking another jump on the bottom line? Nothing, except for the conviction that we don't have enough capacity. Well, now we know differently. Now we know that we have a lot of spare capacity. How much spare capacity do we actually have? Stacy, how much of the current load on the oven in the NCX-10 is due to the fictitious orders?
Roughly 20%.
Marvelous! We have enough capacity to really take the market. I'd better drive to headquarters tomorrow morning and have a heart-to-heart talk with Johnny Johns. Lou, I'll definitely need you. On second thought, Ralph, will you join us? And bring your computer with you. We're going to show them something.
Chapter 38. It's 6 o'clock in the morning when I pick up Lou and Ralph at the plant. I decided that it will be best, since picking them up at their houses would mean I would have had to leave home close to 5. In any event, we're probably not going to spend more than a few hours at headquarters, so it's reasonable to assume that we'll be back at work in the afternoon. We hardly talk. Ralph, in the back seat, is busy with his laptop computer. Lou probably thinks that he's still in bed. I drive on automatic pilot. That is to say that my mind is busy constructing imaginary conversations with Johnny Johns. I somehow have to convince him to get many more orders for our plant. Yesterday, in the heat of discovering the amount of free capacity that we have, I looked only on the bright side. Now I wonder if I'm not just asking for miracles. I recheck the numbers in my head. In order to fill our capacity, Johnny will have to come up with over $10 million of additional sales. It's totally unrealistic that he holds so much up his sleeve, so squeezing, begging, and pleading techniques will not help. We'll have to come up with some innovative ideas. Well, the truth is that so far, I haven't been able to come up with any. Let's hope Johnny has some clever ideas. He's the one who's supposed to be the expert in sales.
I want you to meet Dick Paskey. He's one of my best people. Dedicated, professional. Above all, he's full of innovative approaches. I thought it would be a good idea for you to get to know him. Do you mind if he joins us?
On the contrary. We need some innovative ideas. You see, what I want is for you to get my plant additional business. $10 million worth.
Jokers. All of you in production are wonderful jokers. Dick, what did I tell you? It's not easy to deal with plant managers. One is asking me to persuade his client to pay a 10% increase in price. Another wants me to get rid of a pile of old junk for full price. But Alex, you're the best. $10 million.
Johnny, put on your thinking cap. You must find more orders for my plant. $10 million more.
You are serious. Alex, what's happened to you? You know how tough it is to get more business these days. It's dog-eat-dog out there. Everybody is cutting each other's throats for the smallest order, and you're talking about $10 million more?
I don't hurry to respond. I lean back in my seat and look at him. Listen, Johnny, you know that my plant has improved. What you don't know is to what extent it's improved. We're now capable of delivering everything within 2 weeks. We've demonstrated that we never miss an order, not even by one day. Our quality has improved to the extent that I'm sure we're the best in the market. We're very responsive, very quick, and above all, very reliable. This isn't a sales pitch. It's the truth.
Alex, I know all this. I hear it from the best source, from my clients. But that doesn't mean that I can immediately turn it into cash. Sales take time. Credibility is not built overnight. It's a gradual process. And by the way, you shouldn't complain. I'm bringing you more and more sales. Be patient and don't press for miracles.
I have 20% spare capacity. From the lack of response, I understand that Johnny doesn't see the relevance. I need 20% more sales.
Alex, orders are not apples hanging from trees. I can't just go out and pick some for you.
There must be some orders that you decline. Because the quality requirement is too high, or because the client is asking for unreasonably short delivery times, or something. Get me those orders.
You probably don't know how deep the recession is. Today, I accept any order, anything that moves. I know that a lot of dancing will be required later, but the current pressure is simply too high.
If the competition is so fierce and the recession is so deep, then it must be that clients are pressing for lower prices.
Pressing is not the word. Squeezing is more appropriate. Can you imagine, and this is just between us, in some cases I'm forced to accept business for practically zero margin.
I start to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Johnny, do they sometimes demand prices that are lower than our cost?
Sometimes. All the time.
And what do you do?
What can I do? I try to explain the best I can. Sometimes it even works.
I'm ready to accept orders for 10% below cost. Johnny doesn't hurry to answer. His people's bonuses are based on total sales dollars.
Forget it.
Why? Why should I forget it?
Because it's stupid. Because it doesn't make any business sense. Alex, I don't know what tricks you have in mind, but let me tell you, all those tricks have a very short lifespan before they explode in your face. Why do you want to ruin a promising career? You've done an outstanding job. Why go and mess it up? Besides, if we lower prices for one client, it's just a matter of time until the others find out and demand the same. What then?
He has a point. The last argument shows that the light at the end of the tunnel was just a train. Help comes from an unexpected side.
Zhongli is not connected to our regular customers. Besides, with the quantities he's asking for, we can always claim we gave him a volume discount.
Forget it. That bastard is asking us to give him the goods for basically nothing. Not to mention he wants us to ship to France at our expense. This French guy has chutzpah. It's unbelievable. We negotiated for 3 months. We established each other's credibility. We agreed on terms and conditions. It all takes time. He asked for every technical detail that you can imagine, and we're not talking about one or two products. It's for almost the entire range. All this time, not even a peep about prices. At the end, just 2 days ago, when everything is agreed, he faxes me that our prices are not acceptable and sends us his counteroffer. I was expecting the usual thing, asking for price reductions of 10%, maybe 15% considering the large quantities that he's willing to buy. But no, these Europeans probably have a different perception. For example, Model 12, the one you pulled such a miracle on, our price is $992. We sell it to Burnside for $827. They're a big client and they consume very large quantities of this particular product. The bastard had the nerve to offer $701. Did you hear that? $701. Now you understand?
What's our material cost for Model 12?
$334.07.
Johnny, are you sure that accepting this order will not have any impact on our domestic clients?
Well, not unless we go out and sing it from the rooftops. On this point, Dick is right. No impact. But the whole idea is ridiculous. Why are we wasting our time?
I look at Lou. He nods. We'll take it. Johnny doesn't respond. We'll take it!
Can you explain what's going on?
It's very simple. I told you that I have spare capacity. If we take this order, the only out-of-pocket cost to produce these products will be the cost of the materials. We'll get $701, and we'll pay $334. That's $378 to the bottom line per unit.
It's $366.93 per unit, and you forgot the freight.
Thank you. How much is the air freight per unit?
I don't remember, but it's not more than $30.
Can we see the details of that deal? What I'm particularly interested in is the products, the quantities per month, and the prices. Johnny gives me a long look and then turns to Dick.
Bring it. I don't get it. You want to sell in Europe for a price that is much less than we get here, even less than the production cost, and you still claim that you'll make a lot of money? Lou, you're a controller. Does it make sense to you?
Yes.
Seeing the miserable expression on Johnny's face, I jump in before Lou has a chance to explain. Financial calculations showing the fallacy of the product cost concept won't help. It will just confuse Johnny even more than he's confused now. I decide to approach it from another angle. Johnny, where do you prefer to buy a Japanese camera? In Tokyo or in Manhattan?
In Manhattan, of course.
Why?
Because in Manhattan it's cheaper. Everybody knows that. I know a place on 47th Street where you can get a real bargain. Half price compared to what they asked me to pay for it in Tokyo.
Why do you think it's cheaper in Manhattan? Ah, we know. Transportation prices must be negative.
Okay, Alex, you've convinced me. I still don't understand, but if it's good for the Japanese, it must be profitable.
We work on the numbers for almost 3 hours. It's a good thing that I brought both Ralph and Lou. We calculate the load that this large deal will place on the bottlenecks. No problem. We check the impact on each of the 7 problematic work centers. 2 might reach the dangerous zone, but we can manage. Then we calculate the financial impact. Impressive. Very impressive. At last, we're ready. Johnny, I have one more question. What guarantees that the European manufacturers won't start a price war?
What do you care? With such ridiculous prices, I'm going to lock in Monsieur Jongleur for at least another year.
Not good enough.
Now you're really getting difficult. I knew this was too good to be true.
That's not the point, Johnny. I want to use this deal as a beachhead to penetrate Europe. We can't afford a price war. We must come up with something else beside price, something that will make it very difficult to compete with us. Tell me, what's the average supply time in Europe?
About the same as here, 8 to 12 weeks.
Good. Promise your monsieur that if he commits to the quantities per year, we'll deliver any reasonable quantity within 3 weeks of receiving his fax.
Are you serious?
Dead serious. And by the way, I can start to deliver immediately. I have whatever's needed for the first shipment in stock.
I guess it's your neck. What the heck. In any event, you will have full responsibility very shortly. If I don't hear from you, I'll fax him tomorrow. Consider it a done deal.
Only after we pull out of the parking lot do we let ourselves go. It takes us more than 15 minutes to settle down. That is, Lou and Ralph dive into polishing the numbers. From time to time, they come up with a slight correction, usually not more than a few $100s. Compared to the total deal, it's not significant at all, but Lou finds it relaxing. I don't let it bother me. I sing at the top of my voice. It takes us more than half the way home until they're satisfied. Lou announces the final number. The contribution to the net profit of the plant is an impressive 7 digits, a fact that doesn't deter him from specifying it down to the last cent. Quite a profitable deal, and to think that Johnny was about to drop it. What a strange world.
One thing for sure, you can't rely on marketing people to solve the marketing problems. They're captured by old, devastating common practices to an even larger extent than production. Try to imagine the reaction of people when I start to explain to them they are the ones who believe too much in cost accounting.
Yes. Judging from today, I shouldn't expect much help from these guys, even though, you know, there might be something in Dick.
Hard to tell, especially when Johnny is holding him so tightly under his thumb. Alex, how are you going to do it?
Do what?
Change the entire division.
That puts an end to my euphoria. Damn you, Lou. Why do you have to bring it up? God have mercy on me. Yesterday, we were talking about inertia. We were complaining about the inertia that we have. Compare it to the inertia that we're going to face in the division.
Oh, God.
This week, even though we made such impressive progress, one thing was definitely proven. I'm still managing by the seat of my pants. Take yesterday, for example. If it weren't for Ralph's instinct that something was missing, we wouldn't even have noticed the huge open opportunities. Or today, how close was I to giving up? If it hadn't been for Lou putting us on the right track. I must find out just what are the management techniques I should master. It's simply too risky not to. I must concentrate on it. I even know where to begin. Maybe I was holding the key all along. What did I say to Julie in the restaurant? My own words echo in my head. When did Jonah have the time to learn so much? As far as I know, he never worked one day of his life in industry. He's a physicist. I can't believe that a scientist sitting in his ivory tower can know so much about the detailed realities of the shop floor. And then the idea of scientist came up again when Lou and Ralph were arguing about the usefulness of classifying data. And I myself supplied the answer. How does one go about revealing the intrinsic order? Lou asked it as if it were a rhetorical question, as if the obvious answer was that it's impossible. But scientists do reveal the intrinsic order of things, and Jonah is a scientist. Somewhere in the scientific method lies the answer for the needed management techniques. It's obvious, but what can I do? I can't read a book in physics. I don't know enough mathematics to get through even the first page. But maybe I don't need it. Jonah stressed that he wasn't asking me to develop the methods, just to determine clearly what they should be. Maybe popular science books would be sufficient. At least I should give it a try. I should go to the library and start digging. The first modern physicist was Newton, and that's probably the place to start. I'm sitting in my office, my feet up on the desk and staring blankly into the room. The entire morning, I got only two calls, both from Johnny Johns. First, he called to inform me that the deal with the French is signed. He was very proud of the fact that he negotiated a better deal than expected. In return for the flexibility and immediacy of our response to their future requests, he succeeded in squeezing slightly higher prices. The second time, he wanted to know if he could approach our domestic clients with the same concept. That is, to shoot for a long-term contract where only the overall yearly quantities are fixed, and we promise 3 weeks' delivery for any specific request. I assured him that we don't have any problem responding and encouraged him to go ahead. He's excited. I'm far from it. Everybody is busy. Launching this huge new deal has made them really busy. I'm the only one who has nothing to do. I feel redundant. Where are the days of the telephone ringing off the hook, when I had to run from one important issue to the other, when there were not enough hours in the day? All those calls and meetings were firefighting, I remind myself. No fires, no fighting. Now, everything is running smoothly. Almost too smoothly. Actually, what bothers me is that I know what I should be doing. I need to guarantee that the current situation will continue, that things are thought out in advance so fires will not break out. But this means finding the answer to Jonah's question. I stand up and leave. On my way out, I say to Fran, in the unlikely event that anyone needs me, I'll be at the public library.
Enough for today. Julie, join me for a cup of tea?
Good idea. I'll be with you in a minute.
You're really into it.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
What can be so fascinating about ancient Greek philosophy?
It's not what you think. These dialogues of Socrates are really interesting.
If you say so.
Alex, your perceptions are all wrong. It's not at all like what you think.
So, what is it?
Well, it's hard to explain. Why don't you try to read them yourself?
Maybe one day I will. But for the moment, I have enough reading to do.
Did you find what you're looking for?
Not exactly. Reading popular science books doesn't lead you directly to management techniques. But I've started to see something interesting.
Yes?
It's how physicists approach a subject. It's so vastly different from what we do in business. They don't start by collecting as much data as possible. On the contrary, they start with one phenomenon, some fact of life, almost randomly chosen, and then they raise a hypothesis, a speculation of a plausible cause for the existence of that fact. And here's the interesting part. It all seems to be based on one key relationship. If, then.
Keep going.
What they actually do is to derive the unavoidable results logically from their hypothesis. They say, if the hypothesis is right, then, logically, another fact must also exist. With these logical derivations, they open up a whole spectrum of other effects. Of course, the major effort is to verify whether or not the predicted effects do exist. As more and more predictions are verified, it becomes more obvious that the underlying hypothesis is correct. To read, for example, how Newton did it for the law of gravity is fascinating.
Why?
Things start to be connected to each other. Things that we never thought were related start to be strongly connected to each other. One single common cause is the reason for a very large spectrum of different effects. You know, Julie, it's like order is built out of chaos. What can be more beautiful than that?
Do you know what you have just described? The Socratic dialogues. They're done in exactly the same way, through exactly the same relationship. If, then. Maybe the only difference is that the facts don't concern material, but human behavior.
Interesting. Very interesting. Come to think about it, my field, management, involves both material and people behavior. If the same method can be used for each, then it's probably the basis for Jonah's techniques.
You're probably right. But if you are, then I'm willing to bet that when Jonah starts to teach you those techniques, you'll find that they are much more than techniques. They must be thinking processes. Huh. Where do we take it from here?
I don't know. Frankly, I don't think that all this reading really gets me any closer to answering Jonah's question. Remember what he said? I'm not asking you to develop the management techniques, only to determine what they should be. I'm afraid I'm trying to jump to the next step, to develop them. Determining the management techniques must come from the need itself, from examining how I currently operate, and then trying to find out how I should operate.
Chapter 39.
Any messages?
Yes, from Bill Peach. He wants to talk to you.
Hey, Bill, what's up?
I just received your numbers from last month. Congratulations, Hotshot. You've definitely made your point. I've never seen anything even remotely close to this.
Thank you. By the way, what are the results at Hilton Smythe's plant?
You must twist the dagger, huh? Well, as you predicted, Hilton is not doing too well. His indicators continue to improve, but his bottom line continues to sink into the red.
I told you that those indicators are based on local optima and that they have nothing to do with the global picture.
I know. As a matter of fact, I think that I knew it all along, but I guess an old mule like me just needs to see the proof in black and red. Well, I think that I've finally seen it.
It's about time. So what's next?
Well, this is why I called you, Alex. I spent the entire day yesterday with Nathan Frost, and it seems that he's in agreement with you, but I can't understand what he's talking about. Well, there was a time that I thought I understood all this mumbo-jumbo of cost of goods sold and variances, but after yesterday, it's obvious that I don't. I need someone who can explain it to me in straight terms, someone like you. You do understand all this, don't you?
I think I do. Actually, it's very simple. It's all a matter of...
No, no. Not on the phone. Besides, you have to come here anyway. Only 1 month left, and you should get familiar with the details of your new job.
Tomorrow morning, okay?
No problem. And Alex, you have to explain to me what you've done to Johnny Johns. He goes around claiming that we can make a lot of money if we sell below what it cost us to produce, and that is pure baloney.
See you tomorrow. Bill Peach abandoning his precious indicators? This is something I have to tell everyone. They'll never believe it. I go to Donovan's office, but he's not there, nor is Stacy. They must be on the floor. I ask Fran to locate them. In the meantime, I'm going to Lou to tell him the news. Stacy reaches me there.
Hey, boss. We have some problems here. Can we come in half an hour?
No rush. It's not so important. Take your time.
I don't agree. I'm afraid that it is important.
What are you talking about?
It probably has started. Bob and I will be in your office in half an hour, okay?
Okay. Lou, do you know what's going on?
No. Unless, of course, you're referring to the fact that Stacy and Bob have been busy for the last week playing expediters.
They are?
To make a long story short, already 12 work centers are on unplanned overtime.
The situation is out of control. Yesterday, one order was not shipped on time. Today, three more will be delayed for sure. According to Ralph, we're going downhill from there. He claims that before the end of the month, we'll miss the shipping dates on about 20% of our orders, and not by just 1 or 2 days.
I'm looking at my phone. It won't take more than a few days, and this monster will ring off the hook with furious complaints. It's one thing to be consistently bad. The clients are used to it, and they protect themselves by stocks or time buffers. But now we've spoiled them. They are already used to our good performance. This is much worse than I've imagined. It might ruin the plant. How did it happen? Where did I go astray? How come?
I told you. Order number 49318 is stuck because of...
No, Bob. It's not the details that are important. We should look for the core problem. Alex, I think that we simply accepted more orders than we can process.
That's obvious, but how come? I thought we checked that the bottlenecks have enough capacity. We also checked your 7 other problematic work centers. Did we make a mistake in the calculations?
Probably.
Not likely. We checked and double-checked it.
So?
So I don't know. But it doesn't matter. We have to do something now and fast.
Yes, but what? As long as we don't know what caused the situation, the best we can do is to throw punches in all directions.
That was our old mode of operation. I had hoped that we had learned better. I accept their lack of response as agreement. Let's call Lou and Ralph and move into the conference room. We must put our heads together to figure out what's really going on.
Let's get the facts straight. Bob, are you convinced that you need to keep using so much overtime?
The efforts of the last few days have convinced me that even with overtime, we're going to miss due dates.
I see. Ralph, are you convinced that at the end of the month, in spite of the overtime, we are going to be late on many orders?
If we don't find a smart way to solve this mess, without a doubt. I can't tell you the dollar amount. That depends on Bob and Stacy's decisions of how much overtime to use and which orders to expedite. But it's in the neighborhood of over $1 million.
That's bad. I'll have to redo my forecast.
That is the major damage that he sees? Redo the forecast? Can we address the real issue? Listen again to what you're saying. I don't see a major problem. It's obvious that we tried to swallow more than we can chew. What we have to do is to determine by how much and then compensate. It's as simple as that. Lou nods his head in approval. Bob, Ralph, and Stacy continue to look at me with poker faces. They even look offended. There must be something wrong in what I've said, but I can't see what. Ralph, by how much are our bottlenecks overloaded?
They're not overloaded.
No problem there, so let...
He didn't say that.
I don't understand. If the bottlenecks aren't overloaded, then...
From time to time, the bottlenecks are starved. Then the work comes to them in a big wave.
And then we don't have a choice but to go into overtime. That's the case all over the plant. It looks like the bottlenecks are moving all the time.
What can we do now?
If it were as easy as determining some overloads, don't you think we would easily solve it?
She's right. I should have more confidence in them. My apologies.
Look, we can't handle it by shuffling priorities and going into overtime. We've already tried that for several days. It might help save some specific orders, but it throws the entire plant into chaos, and then many more orders are in trouble.
Yes. Brute force seems to push us more and more into the spiral. That's why we asked for this meeting.
I accept their criticism. Okay, fellows, it's obvious that we have to approach it systematically. Anyone get an idea where to begin?
Maybe we should start by examining a situation where we have one bottleneck.
What's the point? We now have the opposite. We are facing many traveling bottlenecks.
I don't have any other suggestion, nor does anyone else. I decide to gamble on Ralph's hunch. It worked in the past. Please proceed. He goes to the board and takes the eraser.
Well, at least don't erase the 5 steps.
Well, they don't seem to help us much. Identify the system's constraints. Well, that's not the problem now. The problem is that the bottlenecks are moving all over the place.
Nevertheless, he puts the eraser down and turns to the flip chart. He draws a row of circles.
Suppose that each circle represents a work center. The tasks are flowing from the left to the right. Now let's suppose that this one is a bottleneck.
And he marks one of the middle circles with a big X.
Very nice. Now what?
Now let's introduce Murphy into the picture. Suppose that Murphy hits directly on the bottleneck.
Then the only thing left to do is to curse wholeheartedly. Throughput is lost.
Correct. But what happens when Murphy hits anywhere before the bottleneck? In such a case, the stream of tasks to the bottleneck is temporarily stopped, and the bottleneck is starved. Isn't this our case?
Not at all. We never operated that way. We always make sure that some inventory accumulates in front of the bottleneck. So when an upstream resource goes down for some time, the bottleneck can continue to work. As a matter of fact, Ralph, we had so much inventory there that we had to choke the material release to the floor. Come on, that's exactly what you're doing on your computers. Why do we have to regurgitate what we all know by heart?
I just wondered if we really know how much inventory we should allow to accumulate in front of the bottlenecks.
Bob, he has a point.
Of course I have. We wanted 3 days' inventory in front of each bottleneck. I started with releasing material 2 weeks before it was due at the bottleneck. Then it turned out that that's too much, so I cut it to 1 week, and everything was okay. Now it's not okay.
So increase it back.
I can't. It will increase our lead time beyond what we currently promise.
What's the difference? In any event, we're sliding on our promises.
Wait. Before we do anything drastic, I want to understand better. Ralph, let's go back to your picture. As Bob pointed out, we do hold some stock in front of the bottleneck. Now, let's suppose that Murphy hits somewhere before the bottleneck. Then what?
Then the flow of parts to the bottleneck stops, but the bottleneck, using the stock that accumulated right in front of it, continues to work. Of course, that eats into the stock, and so if we don't build enough stock to start with, the bottleneck might go down.
Something doesn't match. According to what you just said, we have to guarantee the uninterrupted work of the bottleneck by building stock that will last more than the time to overcome Murphy on the upstream resource.
Correct.
Don't you see that it can't be the explanation?
Why?
Ralph doesn't get it, and neither do I.
Because the time to overcome a problem upstream did not change. We haven't faced any major catastrophes lately. So if the stock was sufficient to protect the bottlenecks before, it must be sufficient now as well. No, Ralph, it's not a matter of insufficient stocks. It's simply new wandering bottlenecks.
I guess you're right.
Maybe Ralph is convinced by Stacy's argument, but I'm not. I think that Ralph might be right after all. We just have to carry his line of thought a little further. We said that when one of the upstream resources goes down, the bottleneck starts to eat into its stock. Once the problem is corrected, what do all the upstream resources have to do? Remember, if there's one thing that we can be sure of, it's that Murphy will strike again.
All upstream resources now have to rebuild the inventory in front of the bottleneck before Murphy hits again. But what's the problem? We released enough material for them.
It's not the material that concerns me. It's the capacity. You see, when the problem that caused the stoppage is overcome, the upstream resources not only have to supply the current consumption of the bottleneck, at the same time, they have to rebuild the inventory.
That's right. That means that there are times when the non-bottlenecks must have more capacity than the bottlenecks. Now I understand. The fact that we have bottlenecks and non-bottlenecks is not because we designed the plant very poorly. It's a must. If the upstream resources don't have spare capacity, we won't be able to utilize even one single resource to the maximum. Starvation will preclude it.
Yes, but now the question is, how much spare capacity do we need?
No, that's not the question. Just as your previous question, how much inventory do we need, is not the real question either.
I see. It's a trade-off. The more inventory we allow before the bottleneck, the more time is available for upstream resources to catch up. And so, on average, they need less spare capacity. The more inventory, the less spare capacity, and vice versa.
Okay, now it's clear what's happening. The new orders have changed the balance. We took more orders, which by themselves didn't turn any resource into a new bottleneck, but they did drastically reduce the amount of spare capacity on the non-bottlenecks, and we didn't compensate with increased inventory in front of the bottleneck.
Everybody agrees. As usual, when the answer finally emerges, it's plain common sense. Okay, Bob, what do you think you should do now? He takes his time. We wait. Finally, he turns to Ralph.
We have outstanding promises for very short delivery times on only a small percent of our order intake. Can you identify those orders on an ongoing basis?
No problem.
Okay. For those orders, continue to release material 1 week in advance. For all others, increase it to 2 weeks. And let's hope that'll be enough. Now, we have to rebuild the inventory in front of the bottlenecks and in front of assembly. Stacy, take all the necessary steps to put the plant, and I mean all the non-bottlenecks, to work throughout the weekend. Don't accept any excuses. It's an emergency. Now, I'll notify sales that until further notice, they should not promise any delivery in less than 4 weeks from receipt of the order. It'll jeopardize their new campaign, but that's life.
Right in front of our eyes, the baton has been passed. It's obvious who's the boss now. I feel proud and jealous at the same time.
Bob has taken over very nicely. At least this front is covered.
Yes, but I hate to put him in a position where his first independent actions are so negative.
Negative? What do you mean by negative?
Lou, all the actions he's forced to take are leading in the wrong direction. Of course, he doesn't have any choice. The alternative is much worse.
Alex, but I'm probably thicker than usual today, but I really don't understand. What do you mean by leading in the wrong direction?
Don't you see? What's the unavoidable result of telling sales that they should quote 4 weeks delivery? Remember, just 2 weeks ago, we went out of our way to persuade them to quote 2 weeks. They didn't have much confidence then. Now it'll cause them to drop the entire sales campaign.
What else can we do?
Probably nothing. But this doesn't change the end result.
Future throughput is down.
I see. On top of it, overtime is up significantly. Putting the plant to work on the weekend will consume the entire overtime budget for the quarter.
Forget the budget. When Bob has to report it, I'll be the divisional president. The increased overtime is increasing operating expense. The point is that throughput will be down, operating expense will be up, and increasing the buffers means that inventory will be up. Everything's moving in the opposite direction of what it should.
Yep.
Somewhere, I've made a mistake. A mistake that now is causing us to pull back. You know, Lou, we still don't know what we're doing. Our ability to see what's in front of us resembles that of moles. We're reacting rather than planning.
But you've got to agree that we're reacting much better than before.
That's not a real comfort, Lou. We're also moving much faster than before. I feel as if I'm driving, looking only in the rearview mirror. And then, when it's almost too late, we make last-minute course corrections. It's not good enough. It's definitely not good enough.
Chapter 40.
I'm driving back from headquarters with Lou. We've been doing this every day for the last 2 weeks. We are not in what one might call a cheerful mood. Now we know every little detail of what's going on in the division, and the picture doesn't look good at all. The only bright spot is my plant. No, I should get used to the fact that it's Donovan's plant. And it's not a bright spot. That's a gross understatement. It's the real savior. Donovan succeeded in getting everything under control before the clients had any reason to complain. It will take him some time to regain the confidence of our salespeople, but with me pressing from the other side, it will not take long before it'll be okay. This plant is so good that Lou and I were led astray for some time. The reports on the division gave us the impression that the situation is quite good. Only when we went through the elaborate work of separating out Donovan's plant was the real picture exposed, and it's not pretty. It's actually quite disastrous. Lou, I think we did the exact thing that we knew we shouldn't do.
What are you talking about? We haven't done anything.
We have gathered data. Lots of data.
Yes, and there's a problem with the data. Frankly, I've never seen such a sloppy place. Every report is missing at least backup details. You know what I found today? They don't even have a report on late receivables. The information is there, but can you believe it's scattered in at least three different places? How can they operate this way?
Lou, you're missing the point.
Am I? Do you know that with proper attention we can reduce the open receivables by at least 4 days?
And that will save the division.
No, but it will help.
Will it? Do you really believe it will help? Look, Lou, what have we learned? What did you yourself say when you asked for the job? Do you still remember?
I don't know what you're talking about. Don't you want me to correct things which are obviously wrong?
How am I going to explain it to him? Lou, suppose that you do succeed in collecting 4 days out of the open receivables. By how much will throughput, inventory, and operating expense be improved?
They'll all be slightly improved, but the major impact will be on cash. You shouldn't sneeze at 4 days' cash. Besides, improving the division requires many small steps. If everyone does his share, together we can lift it.
I drive silently. What Lou said makes sense, but somehow I know that he's wrong. Dead wrong. Lou, help me here. I know that improving the division will require many small improvements, but...
But what? Alex, you are too impatient. You know what they say, Rome was not built in a day.
We don't have hundreds of years. Lou is right. I am impatient. But shouldn't I be? Did we save our plant by being patient? And then I see it. Yes, many small actions are needed, but that doesn't mean that we can afford to be satisfied with actions that improve the situation. We must carefully choose which ones to concentrate on, otherwise. Lou, let me ask you, how much time will it take you to change, for internal purposes only, the way that we evaluate inventory?
The mechanical work is not a real problem. That won't take more than a few days. But if you're referring to the work it'll take to explain the ramifications, to explain to managers how this affects their day-to-day decisions, that's a different story. With concentrated effort, I'd say it'll take weeks.
Now I'm on solid ground. What do you think is the impact of the way we currently evaluate inventory on the levels of finished stocks that the division currently holds?
Significant.
How significant? Can you give me a number?
I'm afraid not. Not even a meaningful evaluation.
Well, let's try and do it together. Have you noticed the increase in finished goods that the division is holding?
Yes, I have. But why are you surprised? It's exactly what should be expected. Sales are down, and the pressure to show profits is up. So they build finished goods inventory to generate fictitious inventory profits. I see what you mean. We can take the increase in finished goods as an indicator of the impact of the way we value inventory. Wow, it's about 70 days.
Lovely. Compare it to your 4 days of receivables. On what should you work? Moreover, what is the impact on throughput?
I don't see any. I see very clearly the impact on cash, on inventory, and on operating expense, but not on throughput.
Don't you? What was the reason that they gave us for not introducing the new models? Can you recall?
Yes. They are convinced that introducing the new models will force them to declare all the old ones they're holding in stock as obsolete. That would cause a major blow to the bottom line.
So, we continue to offer the old stuff rather than the new. We continue to lose market share, but it's better than biting the bullet of write-offs. Do you understand now the impact it has on throughput?
Yes, I do. You are right. But, Alex, you know what? With some extra effort, I think that I can handle them both. I can work on the problem of the way we value inventory, and at the same time arrange for more attention to the receivables.
He still doesn't get it, but now I think I know how to handle it. What about the plant indicators?
Well, that's a real Pandora's box.
What's the damage there? Slightly bigger than 4 days? And what about the fact that sales continue to judge opportunities according to the formal product cost and desirable margins? Or even worse, that they will look for anything that they can sell above variable cost. What's the damage there? And what about the transfer prices between us and the other divisions? That's a real killer. Do you want more?
Stop, stop. You made your point. I guess I was inclined to deal with the open receivables issue, just because there I know what to do, while in all the others...
Afraid?
Well, frankly, yes.
So am I. Where do we start? Where do we continue? On what should we concentrate first? On what second? It's overwhelming.
We need a process, that's obvious. It's too bad that the 5-step process that we developed turned out to be false. No, wait a minute, Alex. That's not the case. At the end, the problem was not wandering bottlenecks. It was insufficient protection for the existing bottlenecks. Maybe we can use that 5-step process.
I don't see how, but it's worthwhile to check it. Should we head to the plant and give it a try?
Certainly. I'll have to make some phone calls, but it's no problem.
No. I have some commitments for tonight.
You're right. It's very important, but not urgent. It can wait for tomorrow.
Lou reads from the board.
Identify the system's constraints. Do we accept it as the first step?
I don't know. Let's examine the logic that brought us to write it. Do you remember what it was?
Roughly. It was something about the fact that we adopted throughput as the number one measurement.
I'm afraid that roughly is not good enough. At least not at such an early stage in our analysis. Let's try again from first principles.
I'm all for it. But what do you call first principles?
I don't know. Something basic that we accept without hesitation.
Fine. I have one for you. Every organization was built for a purpose. We haven't built any organization just for the sake of its mere existence.
Correct. Even though I know some people in some organizations who seem to forget it.
Washington, you mean?
Well, that too. I was thinking about corporate, but never mind. Let's keep going. Another basic fact is that any organization is composed of more than one person. Otherwise, it's not an organization.
Correct. But I don't see the point in all this. I can give you many more correct statements about organizations in general.
Yeah, you probably can, but look at the conclusion that we can derive already. If any organization was built for a purpose, and any organization is comprised of more than one person, then we must conclude that the purpose of the organization requires the synchronized efforts of more than one person.
That makes sense. Otherwise, we wouldn't need to create an organization. The efforts of individuals would suffice. So?
If we need synchronized efforts, then the contribution of any single person to the organization's purpose is strongly dependent upon the performance of others.
Yes, that's obvious. Obvious to everybody except for our measurement system.
Even though I wholeheartedly agree, I ignore his last comment. If synchronized efforts are required, and the contribution of one link is strongly dependent on the performance of the other links, we cannot ignore the fact that organizations are not just a pile of different links. They should be regarded as chains.
Or at least a grid.
Yes, but you see, every grid can be viewed as composed of several independent chains. The more complex the organization, the more interdependencies between the various links, the smaller number of independent chains it's composed of.
If you say so. But that's not so important. The important thing is you've just proven that any organization should be viewed as a chain. I can take it from here. Since the strength of the chain is determined by the weakest link, then the first step to improve an organization must be to identify the weakest link.
Or links. Remember, an organization may be comprised of several independent chains.
Yes, but as you said, the complexity of our organizations almost guarantees that there are not many of them. Fine, Alex. What do we do about the measurements?
Measurements? Where did they come from?
Didn't we agree yesterday that the distorted measurements are the biggest constraint of the division?
Bob Donovan is right. Lou certainly has a fixation on measurements. They are definitely a big problem, but I'm not convinced that they are the constraint.
You're not?
No, I'm not. Do you think that the fact that most of our products are already outdated in comparison to what the competition is offering is not a major problem? Don't you realize that the attitude in engineering, claiming that the basic rule of nature is that a project never finishes on time, is an even bigger problem? And what about marketing? Have you seen any marketing plan that has any chance of turning the situation around?
No. As a matter of fact, everything that I've seen of long-term planning should be more appropriately categorized under long-term bullshitting.
I'm on a roll. Today, asking me about problems is like opening a dam. Wait, Lou, I haven't finished. What about the mentality that's so prevalent in headquarters, the mentality of cover your ass? Haven't you noticed that whenever we asked about something that doesn't go so well, everyone almost automatically started to blame everybody else?
How could I not notice? Okay, Alex, I get your point. There are major problems all over. It seems that in our division there is a whole herd of constraints, not just a few.
I still claim that there are only few constraints. Our division is too complex to have more than a very few independent chains. Lou, don't you realize that everything we mentioned so far is closely connected? The lack of sensible long-term strategy, the measurement issues, the lag in product design, the long lead times in production, the general attitude of passing the ball, of apathy, they're all connected. We must put our finger on the core problem, on the root that causes them all. That's what actually is meant by identify the constraint. It's not prioritizing the bad effects. It's identifying what caused them all.
How are we going to do that? How are we going to identify the divisional constraint?
I don't know. But if we succeeded in doing it here, in our plant, it must be possible to do in the division.
I don't think so. Here we were lucky. We were dealing with physical constraints, with bottlenecks. That's easy. But at the divisional level, we'll have to deal with measurements, with policies, with procedures. Many of them are cast already into behavioral patterns.
I don't see the difference. Here, we had to deal with all the above. Come to think about it, even here, the constraints were never the machines. Yes, we called and still call the oven and the NCX-10 bottlenecks. But if they were true bottlenecks, how come we succeeded to squeeze almost twice as much out of them as before? How come we increased throughput so much without buying more capacity?
But we changed almost every aspect of how to operate them and how we operate everything around them.
That's exactly my point. What aspect of operation did we change? The measurements, the policies, the procedures. Many of them were cast into behavioral patterns. Lou, don't you see? The real constraints, even in our plant, were not the machines. They were the policies.
Yes, I do see, but still there are differences.
What differences? Name one.
Alex, what's the use of pushing me into a corner? Don't you see that there must be major differences? If there weren't, how come we don't even have a clue of what the nature of the divisional constraints is?
That stops me dead. Sorry, you're right. You know, Lou, maybe we were lucky here. We had physical constraints that helped us to focus our attention, to zoom in on the real policy constraint. That isn't the case in the division. Over there, we have excess capacity going through our ears. We have excess engineering resources that we succeeded so brilliantly in wasting. I'm sure that there is no lack of markets. We simply don't know how to put our act together to capitalize on what we have.
That brings us to the real question. How does one go about identifying the system's constraint? How can we zoom in on the most devastating erroneous policies? Or to use your term, how does one go about identifying the core problem, the one that is responsible for the existence of so many undesirable effects?
Yes, that's the question, no doubt. What's written here on the board is still valid. Identifying the system's constraint is the first step. What we now understand is that it also translates into a mandatory demand for a technique by which to do it. Lou, that's it! We found it! Here it is. Here is the answer to Jonah's question. I'm going to call him right now. You can imagine my first sentence. Jonah, I want you to teach me how to identify the core problem.
Alex, I think that it might be a little premature.
Why? Do you have any doubt that this is what I must learn first?
No, on that I'm quite convinced. I just think that maybe you should ask for more. Knowing the core problem exactly might be far from sufficient.
You are right again. It's just that I was looking for the answer for so long.
I understand. Believe me, I understand.
Okay, Lou. What else do you think I should ask Jonah to teach me?
I don't know. But if the five steps are valid, maybe what you should ask for are the techniques required to enable us to carry those steps out. We already found the need for one technique. Why don't we continue to examine the other four steps?
Good idea. Let's proceed. The second step is decide how to exploit the system's constraints. That doesn't make any sense to me. What is the point in trying to exploit an erroneous policy?
It makes sense only if the constraint is physical. But since we do deal with policy constraints, I guess we better move to the next one.
Subordinate everything else to the above decision. Same reservation. If the constraint is not physical, this step is meaningless. The fourth step is elevate the system's constraints. What are we going to do with this one?
What's the problem? If we identify an erroneous policy, we should elevate it. We should change the policy.
How lovely. You make it sound so simple. Change the policy. To what? Is it so simple to find a suitable replacement? Maybe for you, Lou. Not for me.
Oh, for me neither. I know that cost accounting is erroneous, but that doesn't mean I've completely figured out what to replace it with. Alex, how does one go about correcting an erroneous measurement or any other policy?
First, I think that you need the light bulb idea, the breakthrough. The management techniques that Jonah talks about must include the ability to trigger such ideas. Otherwise, those techniques can't be used by mere mortals. You know, Lou, Julie predicted that as I come to it, I'll recognize that we are not dealing here just with techniques, but actually with thinking processes.
It started to look like it, but triggering breakthrough ideas by itself is not enough. An even bigger obstacle is to verify that this idea really solves all the resulting bad effects.
Without creating new ones.
Is it possible at all?
It must be, if we want to plan rather than just react. Yes, Lou. Must be possible. Look what happened to us with our solution of getting more sales. As a direct result of the French order, we threw the plant into a very unpleasant 2 weeks, and we killed, or at least delayed, a good marketing campaign. If we just thought systematically before we implemented it, rather than after the fact, we could have prevented many problems. Don't tell me that it was impossible. All the facts were known to us. We simply didn't have a thinking process that could force and guide us to examine it early in the game.
What do we change to?
Pardon me?
If the first thinking process should lead us to answer the question, what to change, the second thinking process should lead us to answer the question, what to change to. Well, I can already see the need for a third thinking process.
Yes, so can I. How to cause the change. Look at the fifth step. With the amount of inertia that we can expect in the division, the last one is probably the most important.
So it seems.
Do you understand what we are asking for? We are asking for the most fundamental things, and at the same time, we are asking for the world.
I've lost you.
What are we asking for? For the ability to answer three simple questions. What to change? What to change to? And how to cause the change? Basically, what we are asking for is the most fundamental abilities one would expect from a manager. Think about it. If a manager doesn't know how to answer those three questions, is he or she entitled to be called manager? At the same time, can you imagine what the meaning is to being able to hone in on the core problem, even in a very complex environment? To be able to construct and check solutions that really solve all negative effects without creating new ones. And above all, to cause such a major change smoothly without creating resistance, but the opposite, enthusiasm. Can you imagine having such abilities?
Alex, that is what you have done. That's exactly what you have done in our plan.
Yes and no. Yes, that's what we've done. No, Lou, without Jonah's guidance, all of us would be looking for new jobs today. Now I understand why he refused to continue advising us. Jonah said it to me in the clearest way. We should learn to be able to do it without any external help. I must learn these thinking processes. Only then will I know that I'm doing my job.
We should and can be our own Jonas.
Then this reserved person surprises me. He stands up and puts his arm around my shoulder.
Alex, I'm proud to work for you.